This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Sometimes you're just sitting there and the news of the day kind of organizes itself. We found a theme in corporate America today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday, today, the 15th of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with three stories from three different industries, all centered on the theme of now what? With a sub-theme of adapt or, well, don't succeed is the kind way to put it. Story number one is a change at the top of the recently written off as defunct electronics retailer Best Buy. The company this morning named Corie Barry as its new CEO. She'd been chief financial officer the past 3 years. She will replace Hubert Joly, who'd been in charge since 2012 and is widely credited with turning Best Buy around. So Marketplace's Andy Euler has more now on what the change means for Best Buy in its never-ending competition with Amazon and other internet retailers.
Hubert Joly was an outsider. Best Buy brought him in from the hospitality industry to deal with plunging sales and dwindling profits as more people went online to buy TVs and laptops. Joe Feldman is with the consulting firm Telsey Advisory Group.
Hubert Joly helped transform the company and turn things around and show that there is an important position for a consumer electronics retailer in America to go ahead and compete with Amazon.
Under Joly, Best Buy matched online prices, used stores as warehouses to fill online orders, and added services like in-home product installation. The incoming CEO, Corie Barry, played an instrumental role in Best Buy's turnaround. Branding consultant Denise Leon says Barry should move the company even more aggressively into services over gadgets.
Yes, we will continue to have more and more devices and more technology, but the way they're integrated into our lives is becoming more personal, and therefore we require a service provider to be in person with us or provide that kind of in-person service.
Best Buy has so far managed to avoid the fate of belly-up big-box retailers like Circuit City, Toys R Us, and Sports Authority. But Michael Pachter with Wedbush Security says eventually Best Buy's ship is going to run into one of those icebergs it's been dodging.
I believe my kids will never shop at Best Buy ever. They're 19. And I think my kids are pretty average.
He says Best Buy can thrive as an electronics convenience store where you get phone chargers and adapters when you can't wait, but he doesn't think Best Buy needs 1,000 stores to do that. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Story number two this Monday in the now what category is of aviation. American Airlines, Southwest, also United have taken Boeing's 737 MAX completely off their flight schedules into the summertime. Boeing is still working on getting a software fix approved by regulators, but the delay is throwing a whole lot of summer travel plans into disarray. So, to repeat myself, if you are running an airline, now what? Here's Marketplace's Jack Stewart.
Airlines hate unpredictability. Building a flight schedule makes maneuvering your armies to capture the Iron Throne look easy.
If you can imagine a typical flight that might be leaving from Daytona, you know, it may go up to Atlanta. The crew might get off of there and might get onto a different flight. The plane itself might move on to Chicago.
Dorna Rhodes is at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University.
They have a very complex dance they have to do when they're trying to set up their schedule and they're trying to keep it on track.
Planning cancellations in advance is better than having to make late changes. AA and Southwest are cutting over 250 flights per day combined. Now, that's a tiny percentage of their total operations, but the timing is a problem, says Madhu Unnikrishnan of Skrift Airline Weekly.
The summer period is the busiest period in the Northern Hemisphere for airline travel. So this is where, you know, airlines make most of their money for the year.
Airlines can try to lease similar planes, but their pilots, aircrew, and maintenance staff are all specialist. They can't just swap from the 737 to the similarly sized Airbus A320. Tom Shaner at the Center for Aviation Studies at Ohio State University says airlines will just have to run leaner operations.
Ideally, there's a certain number of aircraft held back in reserve every day for contingencies such as mechanical issues and things like that.
So there'll be fewer planes on standby, which means a greater chance of delays through the whole network. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
Story number three in our honestly unplanned theme day of Now What is of Hollywood in the news that a whole lot of writers here have parted ways with their agents. The proximate cause, at least in part, was agencies packaging writers and actors and producers and selling those deals to studios without necessarily passing a fair share of the proceeds along to the talent, as it were. For television writers in particular, the timing is terrible. Spring is hiring season, when networks staff up their new and returning sitcoms and dramas for the fall. Now, it's never great to be without an agent in Hollywood most of the time, but this could be an opportune time to be a smaller, independent agency, in particular, one that's willing to go along with the Writers Guild's new requirements. Marketplace's Justin Ho has that one.
Getting a script in front of a production studio is a struggle for Joaquin Sahagun. He runs a small agency called Avail Talent and represents 10 writers. He says even last week, he shopped around a screenplay to a bunch of studios.
And the answer they gave me is we only work with people we know.
Avail is now one of a handful of agencies that's agreed to stop the practice of packaging and limit commissions to 10%. With the dispute between writers and big agencies like UTA and CAA in full effect, he's now hearing from writers who've had to fire their agents.
I already got a couple of emails in that regard.
Smaller agencies like his can give clients more personalized attention, but they don't have the connections that big agencies do. Lizelle Brandt is an entertainment lawyer.
A lot of the smaller agencies just don't have the capital, the clients to even do the total package, even if they wanted to.
Even under normal circumstances, finding a new agent is already challenging because the relationship between talent and agent is so close, says Cynthia Littleton at Variety.
The role of a talent agent is part matchmaker, part job scout, part editor, part sounding board, particularly for writers.
She says writers are holding out hope that the standoff will resolve itself in the next few weeks, and that many will rehire their agents when that happens. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this tax day just about broke even. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A word here on this tax day for the procrastinators among us. It's easy now at the click of a button or an email to your accountant to file online. And in fact, the overwhelming majority of us do that. But there once was a time back when paper returns were all there was, when those for whom that midnight on April 15th deadline was cutting it pretty close. As Marketplace's Mariel Segarra reports, those days are gone, and so too is the spectacle that came with them.
We're going to go back about 20 years to a post office in Lawrence, Kansas on tax day. It's almost midnight and the place is popping. There's a string band and people are lining the entryway to the main doors, cheering on last minute tax filers. Like this guy in a red, white and blue track jacket who rushes in with an envelope just as a postal worker is closing up, locking the doors from inside. The crowd is amped up. They turn to the postal worker who's behind the glass doors. He caves. Taxpayer guy raises his fists in the air, triumphant. Nobody likes filing their taxes. That's why a lot of us wait until the last minute. But back when way more of us filed by mail, that procrastination led to something kind of beautiful. Parties at the post office on tax day. That was a video you just heard, by the way, courtesy of the Alfred Packer Memorial String Band. Steve Mason is a member, performed on tax day for decades.
It was a huge deal for us around here. It was an extra national holiday.
And not just in Lawrence, Kansas. On tax day, hordes of last-minute filers would descend on post offices around the country. Some would even sit on the floor and do their taxes with a pen and a calculator. Companies saw this as a marketing opportunity. One year in Atlanta and New Orleans, Popeyes gave out coupons for its new po' boy. In L.A. and Chicago, Westin Hotels rolled out mattresses onto the sidewalk, manned by employees in robes. In New York, Snapple sent somebody in a giant banana suit to hand out samples of its new drink called Go Bananas. And then, also in New York, there was Playboy, where Mike Nagel was a marketing executive in the 90s.
We'd give out postage stamps. We'd hand them chocolate, because chocolate's a stress reliever. We'd even give out Tylenol.
And Playboy Playmates would give shoulder massages to taxpayers and exhausted postal workers.
You know, we'd get a couple of questions like, what does Playboy have to do with tax day? And when we'd explain it, we're doing a stress relief promotion. It would kind of put a smile on people's faces.
Protesters would show up, too. April 15th was a chance to get their message in front of a captive audience. Tax day at the post office became a kind of civic ritual, people coming together to meet one of the few deadlines we all share. But these tax day parties don't really happen anymore. Only about 10% of U.S. taxpayers mail their returns, and a lot of post offices have cut back their late hours on tax day. Larry Zelenak, who teaches tax policy at Duke Law School, doesn't think we should all go back to filing by mail, but he says we have lost something here.
A sense of tax paying as a communal obligation rather than something that just happens, between you and TurboTax on your computer.
There are some who are trying to keep the party going. The Columbia University Marching Band in New York has performed tongue-in-cheek inspirational music at the steps of the city's main post office on tax day for almost 40 years. Songs like the Rocky theme and the Final Countdown. I mean, who understands procrastination more than a college student?
I think we all can, in the bottom of our hearts, sort of feel a little in line with like what they're going through in the last second, having to turn those things in.
Cameron Danish plays alto sax and is head of the band. He says even though the event is much smaller than it used to be,
for our band, it's just been a constant tradition, so I think we're just going to keep upholding it.
Tonight at 11:30, they will be there, ready to cheer on the few taxpayers who still do things the old-fashioned way. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Your perspective on tax day will vary directly with the size of your refund or balance due, of course. But while you might be done with your return, for the Internal Revenue Service, tax season doesn't really end on April the 15th. The IRS has to collect everything and then decide which returns to audit. Catch is, there are places in this country where the IRS is auditing more, that is, doing more audits per taxpayer than any other place in this country. The most heavily audited county in the country is Humphrey County's Mississippi. Paul Keel covers the Internal Revenue Service for ProPublica. Paul, thanks for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me.
So first thing I guess I need you to do for me and everybody out there who might not know is tell us a little bit about Humphreys County, Mississippi.
It's a rural, poor county in the Mississippi Delta, mostly African American. And it's apparently famous, as I learned recently, for its catfish.
I did not know that.
Yes, both catfish farms.
That's amazing. It is also the object of intense scrutiny by the Internal Revenue Service of the United States. Why?
Because lots of poor people live there. That's the reason. And the people who live there are working poor, and they claim something called the Earned Income Tax Credit, which is one of our country's biggest anti-poverty programs. Mm-hmm. It's a program that sort of famously has bipartisan roots. It's praised by economists across the spectrum in terms of how efficient it is, in terms of targeting money to people who need it and who will spend it.
Okay, so lots of people in Humphreys County, Mississippi, get the Earned Income Tax Credit. Why is the IRS so interested in the Earned Income Tax Credit, I guess, is the next question.
Yeah, so since the 1990s, Republicans in Congress have put a lot of pressure on IRS to prevent payments going to people who didn't deserve the credit or who didn't qualify for the credit. There is IRS research showing that, you know, there's a number of people who claim it who don't qualify. Mm-hmm. And the IRS says the main reason for that is it's very complicated. Just because someone, a kid, is a dependent doesn't necessarily mean that they're a qualifying child under the credit. And essentially what happens is letters are spit out by computers that go out all over the country to people who get this credit. And usually what people are asked to do is prove that the right. child who they've claimed under this credit qualifies.
Right. And a disproportionate amount of those people live in Humphreys County. We're going to put a map from y'all's story online. But if you look at a map, it's actually kind of stunning. The most audited counties in the United States by the Internal Revenue Service are in this belt that runs through the Deep South. And I'm going to guess there's some poverty correlation there as well, which is to say the IRS audits more poor people than it does rich people.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the map, you see the South, but you also see Native American reservations up in South Dakota and Arizona. You see mostly Latino counties along the Texas border with Mexico. So, yeah, it is, in a way, a map of poverty in this country. But the thing to keep in mind is, again, people are claiming this credit because they are working during the year.
Maybe this is just me, but wouldn't it make more sense for the Internal Revenue Service to audit people where the money is as opposed to people where the money isn't?
Yeah, it's a good question. So what has happened was Congress has drained the IRS of resources going back for the last 8 years. And when you go up the income scale and you're talking about audits of business owners, the wealthy, corporations, those are very labor-intensive audits that you need skilled people to even start those audits. And so those audit rates have gone down much faster than these other audits at the lower end of the income scale. And like I said, these get started in an automated fashion. These letters are spit out.
Right.
And they do have to send their documents in to prove that, for instance, their two-year-old lived with them for over 6 months of the year, which is usually what they have to prove. That's when a person of the IRS end needs to look at it. And that's where the bottleneck is right now. So, you know, I've talked to people who get a letter after they send their documents in saying, I'm sorry, it's going to be at least 6 months before the IRS is even going to look at this stuff.
Right.
In the meantime, you didn't get that refund that you were counting on to, you know, catch up on your car payment or make your rent or what have you.
Which is the purpose of the earned income tax credit to begin with, right?
Yeah, people use it. It's a big deal to low-income communities. So the real damage oftentimes is not getting that refund when they're counting for it.
Right. Paul Keel, a reporter at ProPublica, doing a whole bunch of work, that whole shop is actually, on the Internal Revenue Service. Paul, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
We put those maps I mentioned, they're online, marketplace.org. Coming up.
I don't think people actually quite know like the amount of money that goes through a nightclub.
What it's like when work is a party, but for just like here. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 27 points today, about a 10%, 26,384. The NASDAQ down 8 points, a 10%, 79.76. The S&P 500 off 1 point, basically flat, 29.05. On this tax day, H&R Block up 1%. Banks took a little bit of a hit. Goldman Sachs down 3.8% today. Citigroup slipped less than a 10%. Boeing down 1.1% today. Rival Airbus rose 0.2%. Nike added 0.6% today. Tiger Woods won the Masters. You might have heard. Healthcare stocks rallied. Walgreens Boots Alliance improved 1.4%. Bonds rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.55%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. In trade and tariff news today, there was word that the White House has asked China to change some of the tariffs it has put on U.S. agriculture as the president and his advisors cast their minds forward to the 2020 campaign. American farmers have had a lot on their plates lately. Besides the tariffs, there were the huge storms last week. So we have called Keith Alverson. He's the corn and soybean farmer up in South Dakota that we talk to every now and then. Keith, it's good to have you on again.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
First of all, how's the end of winter, beginning of spring treating you farm-wise?
It is miserable up here in South Dakota. we've had a flood, and we've had about a foot of snow, and we've had ice, mm-hmm. and then it's 60 degrees today. So it's it's all over the place.
So let me ask a city slicker question here. When do you start planting, if you haven't already?
So we like to start planting somewhere between about April 20th and April 25th. The numbers will tell you that if we don't get started kind of around that time, that we start losing yield, especially once we move into May. And so with the snow that we have on the ground, getting started on time is definitely a concern.
You're going to be able to do that?
I don't anticipate it. You know, I mean, we're hoping maybe middle of the next week, but it's going to take some pretty nice weather to get us there.
Huh. We talked to you in the context of corn a lot, but you do soybeans as well. They, of course, have been in the news because of the tariffs and the Chinese and all that. How was last year for you, soybean-wise?
You know, the yields were excellent, but the prices were lousy. Last fall, some of our, at least where we're located, most of our soybeans go to the Asian market, and that's the way the rail takes it. And so we've had a significant price impact in our region on soybean prices because of that. But because of the lack of soybean train shipment, then some of the corn shipments picked up. And so we picked up a little bit of price on the corn end of things.
So net, are you even or are you losing?
You know, I'd say it maybe is fairly close to net, you know, and then we had the market facilitation program from the Department of Ag that, you know, that came through and helped things out as well.
So farmers, as we know, watch the weather a lot. What are you watching more now? You watching the weather or are you watching the news?
Well, right now, you know, front and center is the weather. You know, do we get in on time? And then what kind of impact does that have on us, you know, on the farm level? Just because even our day-to-day business, what we go about and what we do is so dependent upon the weather this time of year.
Yeah. What do you do with yourself if you can't plant because of the weather? I mean, you just like sit around town's terrible, but what do you do?
It is. It's like a racetrack, you know, with the horse and the starting gates.
That's
you know,
true.
we make sure everything's ready to go, and you know, we check everything and check the saddle, and when the gun fires, we're off to the races.
Who decides? I mean, you're running the farm, right? So it's your call. You're the one who looks out the window one morning and says, "Go."
Yep. You know, some of it's so dependent upon the weather. You know, the fields will kind of tell us when they're ready.
Huh.
The wet soil gets a little gray tinge on it when it starts to dry out.
Huh.
And we know at that point, then the field conditions are adequate to go out there and work. And
sure.
If we put the corn in the ground and it gets cold or gets wet again, sometimes that can impact yield as well. And so we really have to kind of keep an eye on the 5 to 10 day forecast.
Huh. Keith Alverson, he does soybeans and corn in Chester, South Dakota. Keith, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Kai.
We've got an every now and then series we do called My Economy. Stories from people out there making a go of it. Today, we go clubbing, as it were. A tale of trying to make a living, trying to run a club.
I am Gregory Alexander. I live in Los Angeles, and I run cultural things, which is a very funny way of putting my industry. But I think because I wear so many different hats, that's probably the only way to put it. The first time we planned a party in a warehouse was my 21st birthday. My parents gave me $500. So I chose to rent a warehouse space in downtown, which is... I can't even believe that amount would have done that at this point, because I know that now they are not that cost. We pulled together all of our friends who were DJs and brought in a bar. And I had my like former roommate up in the rafters, literally throwing confetti in front of a fan because we couldn't afford a confetti cannon. You know, I didn't know that this confetti, for instance, mixed along with the fact that we popped 21 bottles of champagne and people danced on top of all of that, mixed together and wound up ruining their floor. So we were never invited back to that warehouse again. But it was a fun time. And obviously, like, we got bit by the bug, you know? We wound up going to legal venues. That's when Rhonda technically got her birth.
Rhonda is a business that I started 10 years ago with my partner, Lauren. It's a traveling club, basically. We kind of had a come-to-Jesus moment with a friend of ours. He helped us to kind of realize that we shouldn't just split up all the money that we had left over at the end of every night, that we should have a bank going forward that we could then use to continue booking. We went from doing little 300-person venues to nearly 3,000. The whole scene has got so much more expensive. And, you know, I mean, I can't say that we're not that expensive either. You know, what you could have got us to do for like $100 and a hot dinner at some point, now we wouldn't entertain that idea. I don't think people actually quite know like the amount of money that goes through a nightclub. People are probably very unaware of the amount of money that the DJs make these days too, because they're essentially like our rock stars right now, right? So like those fees go up the more that those people are popular. There's a cap on what you can make, obviously. There's only so many bodies you can fit in the door, and you want it to be accessible for people, but I don't think that they really necessarily know what that dollar goes to. Starting something from nothing, that's usually the hardest part. But on the other hand, you know, you don't really have to answer to anybody.
We can't do this series without you unless you tell us your stories. There is a place you can do just that at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, in which we can only nod to the more lasting news of the day, the fire, of course, at Notre Dame. There's a whole thing we probably could have done about the tourism loss to Paris or the cost of fighting a fire like this, but we are going to go a little bit bigger picture, a whole lot more symbolic. Saw this in the Washington Examiner today, a column by Tom Rogan. His pitch is this, that the United States should offer to pay 17.83% of the reconstruction costs of the cathedral. History majors among you will know that 1783 was the year of the Treaty of Paris, ending the Revolutionary War. France, for all the ups and downs, is still this country's oldest ally. Like I said, a whole lot of symbolism. All right, we got to go. Dow off 27 today, a 10%. NASDAQ down 8, also a 10% on that index. S&P 500 basically flat. Our daily production team is Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Daniel Shin. Our special projects desk is Tommy Andres and Eliza Mills. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.